This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Cane toads are back, but would you know a cane toad from an oak toad? And would you know what to do if your dog happened upon one? Later in the show, we'll talk with a Florida trail hiker and a dog trainer about the threat these toads pose, and we'll learn about other things to look for while you're out on the trail hiking. But first, what does it take to kill 500 million otherwise healthy trees? Unfortunately, not much. The culprit behind what's known as laurel wilt disease is truly a tiny David that fells the mighty Goliaths of the forest world. In fact, it's not one culprit, but two: an invasive ambrosia beetle species from Southeast Asia and the fungus that species carries, which then infects healthy trees. It's a concern that goes far beyond the trees that we see in South Florida landscaping, though. The pest and pathogen pair are now reported in 61 of Florida's 67 counties, and the bug and its fungus can infect all manner of trees in the laurel family, trees that give us essential oils used in spices and perfumes, the bay leaves we use to add savory flavors to our food, and the avocados we use in our meals. These are trees that amount to $25 million a year in Florida's agricultural industry. It also could devastate the swamp bay trees of the Everglades, which are a keystone species to the river of grass ecosystem. But there is hope, and a new study looks not only at how this pest arrived in the U.S. and how it's continued to thrive, but also what could help restore some of these trees. Joining us today is forest pathologist Dr. Jason Smith. He's an associate professor at the University of Florida's IFAS School of Forest Resources. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Good to see you.
We are talking about laurel wilt and the threats the disease poses to trees in Florida with a researcher who studied the beetle and the fungus spreading the disease across Southeast U.S. Ask our expert your questions at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Dr. Jason Smith, you are part of a new study that's looking at the Red Bay ambrosia beetle and its connection to laurel wilt disease. Can you tell me how this Southeast Asian beetle made it to the U.S. and to the Southeast U.S. in particular?
Yes. So this beetle exemplifies a lot of invasive species in the sense that it's, you know, there's a lot of different ways they get here. But this one, we think it probably got here by way of solid wood packing material. So being a species that associates with wood, it's most likely that it got here perhaps in pallets or other wood packaging that's associated with shipping. It came here probably somewhere near Savannah, Georgia, is where it was first introduced. That was where the first beetles were detected back around 2002. And the first red bay trees were found dying in that same area. So that's where it's presumed to have been introduced. There's also a large port there called Port Wentworth. So the hypothesis is that it probably was introduced around that region in solid wood packing material. Ambrosia beetles, their biology is that they are typically living in dead and dying trees where they cultivate their fungal symbionts, and they feed on these fungi in those dead and dying trees. So in Asia, that's the typical biology. And presumably this beetle was, you know, maybe in a piece of wood that was used in making some of this wood packaging material and survived the long journey.
Kind of an accidental stowaway?
Exactly. That was the most likely scenario. We can't say that with certainty, of course, because, you know, nobody, you know, saw this actually happen. But this is the most likely pathway, of course.
There were no actual witnesses. So what this beetle does, it goes to an unhealthy tree and then puts fungus on this tree and then lives off of that fungus?
Yeah. So typically ambrosia beetles are doing this in weakened or stressed trees. So when a tree gets stressed by some event like flooding or a lightning strike or something like that, they will bore into the tree, make a little tunnel, and then they actually farm these fungi. So they have a symbiotic relationship with these fungi, which is a long evolutionary relationship with these organisms. And we think of them as fungus farmers. And they will actually cultivate these fungi, specific species even, and use them as a food source. And this is their typical biology. But usually they're doing this in trees that are already either dead or in the process of dying. What's unusual in this case is that this exotic species is boring into perfectly healthy trees here in North America. And as a result, the fungus is inducing the trees to die, and they're doing this very, very quickly. And so this is a shift in the behavior and sort of a shift in the paradigm, actually, of our understanding of these ambrosia beetles. And it's really the result of a new interaction that hasn't happened in the past.
Well, that's odd. So they were in Asia, and they would go only to dead or dying or weakened trees. Here they're going for completely healthy trees.
Exactly. And, you know, this is something that we really don't know the exact reason for this, but it's probably due to the volatiles, that is the gases given off by our living red bay and other related laurel family trees. They're very aromatic. So, of course, you know the bay leaves that you cook with. When you crush them, you smell a nice smell that they give off. Well, insects, you know, they also smell these aromatic compounds given off by these plants, and that's very important for their biology. And we think that the living red bay and related species here in North America give off compounds that apparently confuse the beetles. The beetles are, you know, flying around, and for some reason they'll bore into a perfectly live tree, and it sort of confuses them. And they, in the process, they release some of the spores of their fungal symbiont, and it causes the trees to wilt and die. And that's really very unusual. That's not the typical behavior of these beetles. They typically are very, you know, sort of strict about their behavior of boring into trees that are already on their way out or dead or dying.
So do they have the laurel family of trees in Asia?
They do. I mean, the Lauraceae, the family, the laurel family, is a very, very large family. It's diverse. It has about 600 or more species found throughout the world. And there are many different areas of the world where the species are – or different species are important, but they're different species than the ones we have here. And it's thought that, you know, this beetle co-evolved with those trees in Asia, and that, you know, the system is quite a bit different. We are currently studying those species in Asia and trying to understand how the interaction differs on those species. And so far, the species that we've tested that are native to Asia, that is the tree species that are native to Asia, are resistant to the fungus. So when we inoculate them, they don't wilt and die like the species here. So there is some difference there in terms of how they react to the fungus. How they react to the insect, you know, it still needs to be studied more. Mm-hmm. But it seems like they're not as attractive in their living state as the North American species are.
Yeah, that's really interesting, just that little difference between the laurel trees that they're finding here and then also over there. And right. Then another aspect that makes the beetle and fungus duo unique and more threatening to trees is that they can both essentially reproduce alone, cloning themselves. Does that make it spread faster or easier?
Well, yeah, this was a really surprising result from this research that we did recently. I mean, we were interested in trying to understand the origin of the beetle and the fungus and whether or not there are multiple introductions. And, you know, so we collected samples from throughout the southeastern United States. And the basic hypothesis is that if you have an invasive species, the more diversity you have in that population, the more likely it is to be successful. So if you think of it this way, if you're going to establish a new population somewhere, even if you think of humans, let's say, and you're going to take a bunch of humans to a new planet somewhere, you know, more likely the more diversity you have in that population, the more likely it is to be successful in the long run. Well, in this case, we wanted to look at that. We wanted to say, okay, if we have more diversity in the population, then we would expect that there might have been multiple introductions, maybe from different locations. So we looked at that, and as it turned out, the beetle was completely clonal. In this case, there was no genetic variation at all in the beetle population. And the fungus was completely clonal. So both of them have completely uniform populations in North America. And the beetle itself has an interesting reproductive ability to maintain these clonal populations by way of something called haplodiploid mating, meaning that the females, if there are no males around, she can basically lay eggs, and the eggs are basically genetically identical, and these are essentially clones of the female. And one of the eggs is a male, and the others are females. And the males have half the number of chromosomes as the females. It's interesting. The males are basically, inferior to the females. They're smaller, and they're not even able to fly. But this is part of their biology, and they're actually able to establish entirely new populations from one single adult female. And this actually makes them highly successful in terms of establishing new populations as an invasive species, if you think about it, because it only takes one. And this is exactly what happened here, we think, is that one beetle, potentially one individual, could have started this entire epidemic. One beetle the size of Lincoln's nose on a penny could have started this entire, you know, death and destruction that we've seen. And it's really amazing when you think about that, that this one beetle with one, you know, genetic identity, and then the fungus that it's carrying is also completely genetically identical, has caused the death of this large number of trees, you know, with all this variation that occurs across the landscape. That's really, really unprecedented, and something that I think is a warning sign when we think about, you know, new interactions among species, that this is something that could happen. And this was not on anybody's radar screen also, by the way. I mean, experts that study this type of thing, when the beetle was first found, actually, it was not something that was of too big of a concern, because they, you know, people thought about the typical biology of ambrosia beetles and thought, well, you know, they're normally associated with already dead and dying trees, so this is not likely to be a pest, right?
So they wouldn't think it would be an issue, but once it gets here, it starts attacking healthy trees.
Exactly. So this was a shift in paradigm, and it's something that represents a new sort of potential risk that we have to really be thinking about now in the future, that you know, new interactions among species can develop in ways that we can't predict from past experiences with our understanding of the biology of organisms.
What does this little ambrosia beetle look like? I mean, you said he's very small, but do they look like a little black dot, or do they look like a ladybug?
Yeah, no, they're basically a small, oval, dark brown, relatively shiny. In fact, the species name is glabratus, which means basically shiny. They do have tiny little hairs if you look really closely under the microscope on their back. But they're very, very small. Like I said, they're about the size of Lincoln's nose on a penny. And that's the female, which is the bigger of the two. They're nondescript, and really you're not going to see them unless you're really looking for them. And they're, you know, most of their lifetime is actually inside of the tree. You know, they're, so they do fly around in the evening sometimes. And when you're most likely to find them is if you actually are drinking wine, because they're often are attracted to ethanol or alcohol. So if you're drinking wine in the evening, they'll sometimes fly around. You'll see these tiny little bugs, almost look like a gnat, but they're not, of course. Sometimes those will be ambrosia beetles, and that's when you're most likely to see them. There are a lot of different species, some of which are native, some of which are not native. So just because you find an ambrosia beetle doesn't mean it's this particular one, but this one is by far the most destructive ambrosia beetle that we've ever seen, affecting trees, and it's just unprecedented the amount of damage that it's caused.
So what happens is then this beetle gets in the trees, it burrows in there and puts the fungus there. Is it the fungus that causes the problem for the tree?
That's right. So the fungus in this case is, we think, is initiating a defense response in the tree, much like an immune response or almost like a allergic response in say a human, because the fungus is not really a pathogen in the classic sense, because if you think about it, the fungus is being cultivated by the beetle in dead and dying trees typically. So it's really the lifestyle of the fungus is what we call a saprophyte, or it's living off of the dead tissue in the tree in its normal, environment. But when it's actually put into the live tree, the tree detects it as a foreign invader essentially, and you end up with this defense response in the vascular tissue. So the water conducting tissue in the tree, which, you know, in the what we call the vessels, the part that allows the tree to move water, basically starts blocking itself as a defense response. And it does this very rapidly and essentially throughout the entire tree. And that essentially has the same effect as, you know, shutting down the entire vascular system of the tree. And so the tree wilts and it dies very quickly.
So it's kind of almost like an allergic reaction, like overreacting to a perceived invader.
Absolutely.
Wow.
So if the tree didn't do that, there would really not be much of a problem, because the fungus isn't really that good at doing much in the live tree. And it takes so little of the fungus to do this because the beetle, you know, it's tiny and it's and when it bores into the tree, just a few spores are going into the vascular tissue. But we've done experiments where we've inoculated trees with very, very small amounts of the pathogen. In fact, 100 spores, 100 Canidia, which are a very, very tiny amount of the pathogen, but that's enough to induce this response in the tree. So it's a very hypersensitive type reaction in the tree, and this happens in a short period of time. Like a large tree will die, wilt and die within about 3 to 4 weeks from the time it's inoculated to
the time
it dies.
That's pretty quick. Is there any way that you can tell that this is what's happened to your tree?
Yeah, so if you have a red bay or avocado in your backyard, it will start to show the droopy leaves. Usually a portion of large portion, not just a few leaves, but like a whole branch, large section of it will start kind of turning out sort of an off green or an off color, kind of like a olive green color. It doesn't have that bright green color initially, and the leaves are droopy. Like it looks like it needs water essentially, and that's the first symptom. And then very quickly those leaves desiccate and they turn reddish brown. And they do this so quickly that the leaves don't usually drop off the tree. It happens so fast that the tree doesn't even have time to respond like it typically would if it were under water stress. And they remain attached. So the leaves turn reddish brown, and then they just sort of remain attached to the tree as the tree dies.
Are there little teeny holes where these little beetles have gotten in there?
Eventually, yeah. So the beetles don't initially use the tree for reproduction until after the tree's typically dead. So the initial beetle that inoculates a tree is usually there may be one or just a few, and you don't even notice that. It's usually only after the tree's wilted and dead, usually 4 to 6 weeks later, you would then start to see these little what we call frass noodles or boring dust noodles. They look like little tubes of boring dust coming out of the tree, and they look literally like little tubes or little noodles essentially coming out of the tree. And that will be your evidence that the beetles are boring in. And then you can be pretty clear that or pretty sure that that's what's going on.
And that's what caused your tree to die.
Exactly.
We are talking about the tiny beetle and the fungus that it carries that causes laurel wilt disease and the 500 million trees the disease has killed in the last 15 years. You can give us a call if you want to get in on the conversation at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And we do have a call coming right now from Mark in North Fort Myers. Mark, do you have a question?
Well, no, I just wanted to make a comment, which is even though in this case the disease vector, the spreading it, is an invasive beetle, with the problem really being a fungus, it just sounds very, very much like the incredible disaster that happened with the American chestnut in the early 1900s.
The American chestnut?
Absolutely. That's a great observation. You're right. I mean, yes, this has an insect vector, but in many ways, it's a similar scenario. We have an exotic disease essentially that is affecting a host that has no resistance, and I think in the impact on the host is almost identical in terms of very rapid, almost complete annihilation of the host population. And what we're seeing in terms of changes to the ecosystem and impacts to the ecosystem, would be very analogous. For the listeners that aren't aware of what happened to American chestnut was a keystone species in eastern forests that within about 40 years time was decimated by a fungal pathogen that was brought in probably on ornamental plants that was first discovered around New York City around 1900, and then it spread throughout the Appalachians, completely changing the landscape affected even the economy of the Appalachians, where they depended on the American chestnut.
So, Mark, that was a really interesting observation. Thanks for bringing it to our attention.
Yeah. Well, your guest was very eloquent. Thank you.
Thanks so much. So I wanted to add, once you get this disease in your tree, you start to see that your leaves are wilting and you suspect this might be the problem. Is there any chance of stopping it?
Once the tree starts to wilt, no. At that point, it's essentially game over for that particular tree. The only thing that we recommend would be to remove it as soon as possible and, have the tree chipped. So that it's not used for reproduction by the beetles, especially if you have other trees in the vicinity. There are some treatments that can be done for individual landscape trees, like There are, some fungicide treatments that arborists are doing, that do have some efficacy or preventative treatments that can be done by injecting fungicides into trees. In fact, we just treated the tree in front of our building here on campus last week, but it has to be done about every 12 to 18 months. And so it's not really something that's that can be done in a forest, setting. It's really only for individual landscape trees, that would be of high value. But that's preventative. That's something you're doing before the trees become symptomatic. Once they've become symptomatic, it's too late.
Do these beetles respond to insecticides or anything?
No. The problem with insecticides is that by the time the beetle would actually come in contact with the insecticide, it's already probably too late.
He's already dropped the fungus.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And it only takes one beetle to infect the tree. So far there's been very little success with any insecticides.
And you mentioned earlier that the tree reacts so severely to even the smallest amount of an inoculation. It doesn't sound like there's I'm thinking about allergies again. You know how you give somebody shots, give them a little bit so that they can mm-hmm. get used to it and become accustomed to that perceived invader and then not react in that way anymore. That doesn't sound like it's a possibility with the trees.
No. In fact, we really think the only options really in terms of with the host in this case is genetic resistance. That's really the only long-term solution that we're pursuing, vigorously is that and some other work perhaps with altering the chemistry that the insect vector is reacting to. And so that those are kind of the areas that we're looking at that mm-hmm. we think has the best, the best possible chance of success.
And we have another phone call coming in from Oscar in Fort Myers. Oscar, what would you like to ask?
Hi, yes. My question is the way the gentleman described the symptoms of the trees. I have a palm tree that has very, very similar symptoms with the leaves, very dry. So I'm wondering, does this also affect that? Palm trees, small palm trees.
Okay. Thanks for your question, Oscar, and we'll have the answer off. I'm going to hang up, and I'm going to let you hear the answer on the radio. Are there other trees that are affected by this besides the ones that are in the laurel family? Can they be? Can it impact palm trees?
No. So this disease only affects the laurel family, the Lauraceae. These beetles are very specific in terms of their, of their preference for the Lauraceae. However, Oscar, there are some diseases that are affecting palms, and it should be noted here that this issue of exotic diseases is affecting a much broader range than just the Lauraceae. And I did want to point that out here that that we have similar scenarios with other diseases. So there is a disease affecting palms here in Florida called Texas Phoenix palm decline, sometimes known as lethal bronzing, which is has the potential to have similar impact, and it's a different disease, has a different biology, and you can look up some information online. We have a publication, UF IFAS has a publication on, if you look up Texas Phoenix palm decline, there's information on that. You could search that out if you're interested.
Mm-hmm. And, well, we've heard about the species threatening red bay trees and killing about 300 million of them, according to your study and the data from the USDA Forest Service. Can you tell me about what specific threats this tree poses to species important to the ecology of South Florida? So, if it's wiping out this number of trees, are there other flora and fauna that's dependent upon those trees?
Absolutely, yeah. And so, our study estimated the number of dead trees, just specifically red bay trees that were killed. And of course, red bay has a wide distribution, from Virginia all the way to Florida to Texas. But in fact, South Florida in particular, swamp bay is a closely related species that, is in some cases a dominant canopy tree in the tree islands, which are, ecologically significant component of the Everglades. So in those areas, we're very, very concerned about the loss of those trees because, there aren't a lot of trees in the tree islands where you have this river of grass, of course, and these individual clumps of trees are extremely important for the wildlife. The wildlife utilize those tree islands for habitat and for food and all sorts of things. And there's a lot of hydrological issues associated with those tree islands. And then, of course, if you lose those trees in the tree islands, the concern then becomes what grows there instead. And I think most listeners are well aware of the fact that we have a major issue with invasive plant species in South Florida. And we've already seen that in some of those areas in the tree islands where laurel wilt is killing off the swamp bay, we're seeing invasive plants like things like Brazilian pepper and things like Melaleuca and these other species starting to take over. And so that, you know, leads to a whole other set of issues. In South Florida, we also have a couple of endangered species that are in the Lauraceae that we're very concerned about. One is called lancewood, and the impact to it is still uncertain. We're not sure how it's going to affect lancewood. Lancewood seems to be somewhat moderately susceptible, not as susceptible as swamp bay is, but it has such limited distribution, and there's so few of them that, you know, it wouldn't take a lot for there to be a big issue with it. Also, we have something called Gulf Licaria. Gulf Licaria is a critically endangered species that is susceptible to laurel wilt. So there could be, you know, potentially, you know, that species could become extinct due to laurel wilt. In addition to that, there are lots of organisms like butterfly species, for example, that feed on these plants. We know
that's what I'm thinking of, all the animals that kind of rely on these.
Absolutely. You know, these plants produce a lot of food for other organisms. If it, you know, in the case of butterflies, the larval stage of several butterflies are obligately associated with these plants. That means that these plants are the only food source for these butterflies. Some of these butterflies are the primary pollinators for certain orchid species, like the orange-fringed orchid, for example, that relies on the Palamedes swallowtail. The Palamedes swallowtail feeds obligately on red bay. There's a good example.
That interconnectedness is just so hard to understate. I mean, everything is so connected. So, I mean, when you have something completely being wiped out, not only does it clear the path for other invasive species, it's also, I mean, down the chain, you have what was the name of the orchid?
Orange-fringed orchid.
The orange-fringed orchid that could end up, you know, being in decline because of the lack of food for the bird.
Exactly. We know that, that brings us to, you know, the concern about if this moves into other areas even. Like, we're concerned about the movement of this disease into places like Mexico and Central America, because in those areas, Lauraceae is far more dominant of a tree, you know, tree species in terms of diversity in the forest. And so one of the lab members in my group is from Costa Rica, for example. And so she's helping look at the impact in Costa Rica, because in Lauraceae, it's a, you know, the Lauraceae is very important there. And the quetzal bird, which is the national bird of Costa Rica, depends on a tree called Persea cerulea, which is related to avocado. And so we're very concerned if that species is susceptible. This bird, the quetzal, which depends on the fruits of the Persea cerulea, could be heavily impacted by this. And so we're actually establishing a project to look at the susceptibility of Persea cerulea and other species in Central America and Mexico. But these things all take time, and it's a slow process, of course. But, you know, it's we think there's a huge potential for this to get into those areas. The disease has already been found in East Texas. So it could take one person with a load of firewood or something, you know, to get it into California, get it into Mexico. Yeah.
And pallets, that's our main way of transporting goods, is on wooden pallets.
Absolutely.
But then I wanted to add, you were saying earlier about how you think that the best way is going to be trying to find resistant trees, or trees that are able to resist the overreaction to this fungus. But if you do find those, how can you reforest based on that? Once you do find one that is resistant, there are a lot of trees out there that already exist that are not.
Right. You're totally right. That's a tall order. But we have indeed found some survivors. We've been working on this since about 2007, where we've been surveying areas that have been heavily hit, areas where, you know, 95 to 99% of all the mature trees have been killed. And we've looked for these rare survivors, and then we have gone through this long process of propagating those and then evaluating whether or not they have resistance by doing artificial inoculation experiments, multiple, you know, studies. And some of those have verified that they are, in fact, resistant or tolerant. And we even have seedling populations from those. So we have second generation seedlings from those individual trees and have shown that there's heritability, meaning that the seedlings, a certain percentage of the seedlings are resistant, like the parent mother tree was. What we're doing now is we're testing, working with restoration scientists, people that focus on restoration work and seeing about how we can go about doing restoration work. Because part of it might be to, focus on key areas that, depend on, maybe working on biodiversity efforts, for example, areas where we know we need to encourage the butterfly populations, or, state parks, key areas where we really want to encourage the biodiversity. But it also might be that, nature will also help us with this. If the plants produce seedlings and some of these seedlings are resistant, it will happen on its own to a certain extent. We need to study the best ways to encourage that.
So it does sound at least a little bit promising.
I think so. I mean, I certainly don't think that, that we should let our guard down. I mean, I don't think that it's going to happen without some investment in research and in certainly without a lot of, a lot of work. But it's something that is certainly possible. I mean, even with the American chestnut situation that the previous caller brought up, we are 100 years later restoring forests today using biotechnology and other efforts. People are now planting chestnuts back in the forest, and so it's continuing to happen. I think that we are doing that. In fact, we did plantings this year. The Ordway Swisher Biological Station here at the university, we planted some of our resistant red bays. I wouldn't have thought we'd be at that stage, back in 2007. I mean, it's hard to believe we were able to get that quickly to that stage. But red bay flowers very early. Young plants will produce flowers very quickly. So there's a lot of things that are in our favor, I guess, with it. But
we'll have to remain vigilant, as you say.
Absolutely. And I think the bigger issue is that we have a lot of these problems on, they're every day we're seeing new problems cropping up. This is a big issue, not just for natural resources, but for agriculture in general. We have to really pay attention to these pests and diseases because they threaten our way of living.
Exactly. And I didn't even get to start talking about avocados, but we kind of run up against time. So I'm going to have to leave it there for now. But I do want to thank our guest, Dr. Jason Smith, forest pathologist and associate professor at the University of Florida's IFAS School of Forest Resources. Thanks so much for explaining that all to us today. I mean, it's kind of a complex issue, but I mean, we ended up with a little ray of hope at the end. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Coming up, thanks to all the rain that we've gotten, cane toads are back. These poisonous amphibians may not be on the offensive, but a chance encounter could prove fatal to dogs. We'll learn more after the break. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.